and the tax revenue from a sizable investment in property. The fifth concern, which I will address, is the question of Alaska committing all of its future royalty oil to Alpetco. The answer to this is no. Article 2.4 of the contract provides that Alpetco's option on non-Prudhoe Bay oil is limited. In the first place, it's limited to the amount needed from other locations, if any, to bring the total amount of royalty oil we purchase up to a maximum of 150,000 barrels per day, which was the quantity the state originally indicated its intention to sell, and it is the quantity necessary to provide the assured feedstock supply to the facilities we plan to build. So we must have the feedstock if we're to build the facility. Secondly, such makeup quantity must come from not more than 70% of non-Prudhoe Bay royalty oil, not otherwise committed under existing contracts or renewals of these contracts to North Pole Refining and to Tesoro. So we cannot ask for any of their oil, nor can we ask for more than 70% of any other oil, and we can only ask for this option oil, A, if we're not getting enough from Prudhoe Bay, and B, after we started operating the facility. This option does not come into play until after we've started up the plant. Regarding this so-called 70% option, Milton Lipton told the two special committees of the Senate and House at their joint meetings on March the 15th, quote, "I think if you want this kind of a project, whether it's this group or another group, you're going to have to give assurance of supply." He went on to say, "Nothing's going to fly unless you're prepared to commit the 100 or 125 out of the 150, which means also the right of first refusal over any deficiency out of the Prudhoe Bay royalty oil or other royalty oil anywhere else in the state. That is, whether it's this particular project or whether you say no to this and Dow Chemical comes back 3 years from now, if you're going to offset competitive disadvantages by assured availability, you've got to assure the availability," end of quote. The real question involved with the 70% option is whether or not the legislature wants a petrochemical plant in Alaska. If you want the value added here, fine. If not, it will be added some other place besides Alaska. Do you want the 2,000 to 3,000 new permanent jobs or not? Do you want the $49 million a year we estimate in additional state and local taxes or not? These are questions only you can answer, but they do relate, we feel, and hinge upon keeping in the contract the 70% option provision. Following testimony to the special committee of the House and following its negative reports to the full House, Alpetco, in an effort to clarify any misunderstandings, sent a letter to Governor Hammond in response. This letter was in response to concerns which had been expressed, and it was an attempt to clarify our intent with respect to 3 points which had been mentioned earlier by Commissioner Loresh. First, to clarify the meaning of commit to extend. Secondly, to say that we would not take any oil for 25 months after the effective date of the agreement. And thirdly, to clarify the term so that there was no misunderstanding about the fact that any money we paid for oil would not be counted on the benchmark monetary requirement. Another concern I referred to earlier that has been expressed is that Alpetco is a paper corporation. Because of this question, but more importantly because of the huge financing which will be involved in the Alpetco project, we asked Jim Lott if he would be here to briefly discuss the permanent financing and to answer any questions you have in the financial area. Jim?
Thank you, Charles. Senators, I do represent E.F. Putnam Company. I also represent our co-investment banker, Lehman Brothers Kuhn Loeb, out of New York. We have been involved with Alpetco as financial advisors of this project since its very inception some year ago. We've had several meetings, countless meetings with their bankers, Chemical Bank, and with the company in structuring a financing structure which we think would be marketable. It's been our recommendation that the refinery complex should be financed under what we will call a project financing. And if it's done that way, we're prepared to undertake the project and believe that the funds can be raised. Now, to you folks, gentlemen, senators that are not involved in projects every day, let me try and say in English just what a project financing is. It's really analogous to a, you might look at it as a three-legged stool. If you have all three pegs, the stool stand up. If you don't, it's going to fall down on you. In essence, the lenders, rather than looking at the corporate credit or corporate guarantee, really look at the structure itself and says, are the structure, is the supply contract and the contract management going to support the project? First of all, they'll look at the supply agreement. They look at the adequacy of it. They look at the accessibility of it and the dependability of it. Because this true supply agreement is going to be the first ingredient, the only ingredient, the important ingredient to make the process work. Secondly, they're going to look at management's ability to organize and coordinate that raw material product. And thirdly, they're going to look at the long-term purchase contract. You've got to have a minimum of fixed price, long-term contract to repay the debt. Now, if you've got those three ingredients, supply, assured supply, management, and contract for the output of the refinery, with margin sufficient in the investor's mind to be able to repay the debt, then you have what we call a project financing. And it's a very reasonable one. With so many demands for capital today, more and more corporations have to limit their corporate guarantees to those projects which don't lend themselves so much to a project financing. This is a typical type of financing which in today's environment is being utilized more and more by companies to finance natural resource projects. In the United States, some recent project financings might be helpful. Atlantic Richfield in Channelview, Texas recently did a project financing on a petrochemical complex down there. Union Carbide recently did a coal project in Utah on project financing. In Canada, our United States Steel did a project financing for Quebec Hydroelectric. In British Columbia, they've had Fording Coal and Lornex Copper. These were financed by the takers of the project, where the institutional lenders look to the resources, the management, and the contracts to finance those. In Australia, in the area of iron ore, we've had Savage River, Rogue River, and Hammerfly projects. All these were financed under contracts. I think most pertinently, you can look at Alaska Interstate's involvement recently in the Indonesian project, where they were responsible for restructuring the success of $1.5 billion LNG project, where based on a project financing, Japanese utilities supplied, or based on Japanese contracts, $1.5 billion was completely 100% debt financed. Now, when we've looked at raising capital, you're going to really have to break capital down into two categories, equity and debt. Now, on the equity side, E.F. Hutton Kumho, on December 12, 1977, wrote a letter in which we stated that, this letter was addressed to Alpetco, that if the conditions exist that I just mentioned under project financing, that we were prepared and believed it was feasible to raise the required equity funds to support the financial structure of the refinery complex. We would look for the equity to come from the equity partners that they'll bring into the project. Alpetco has stated in the past that other people will be participants with them. We believe the economics of the project will support equity participation. On top of that, as you know, under the benchmark test, Alpetco will be required to put up $10 million over the first, I believe, it's 18-month period. Together with our raising of equity funds, I believe anyone knowledgeable in the financial community would not refer to this as a paper corporation. Entity project financing corporations grow on themselves structurally and financially as the project proceeds. This is typical. From the debt side, we see the funds coming first from the commercial banks, both domestic and foreign. And Representative Chemical Bank is here today. You've heard him testify before some of your core on just what their commitment to the project was. We're looking for a long-term source of the funds to come from principally the life insurance and casualty insurance markets, the pension, profit, and retirement system. We also believe that a portion of the fund could be financed under your Chapter 61, Title 44, Alaska Industrial Development Authority. Maybe as much as $500 million of that would qualify for tax-exempt financing, which of course lowers the cost of the project by 2% over the cost of corporate funds. So in summary, that's how we see it operating, and I'd be happy to answer any more specific questions you might wish to address to me. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Jim. I'd like to ask next if Gordon Kane will speak to the question of how he feels petrochemicals make sense in Alaska, and perhaps tell you something about how he sees this project proceeding forward. Gordon?
Senator Galletta, gentlemen of the committee, the question has been raised as to whether or not it is possible to build a viable petrochemical operation in Alaska or not. And it's been pointed out that the construction costs in Alaska are higher than here than many other parts of the world, that operating costs here are higher, that the products, the petrochemicals that we plan to make are in long supply all over the world. And if we thought that these conditions would go on forever, I would have to agree with the people who raised the question about the viability of this project. But nothing goes on forever without change, and certainly we think that's true here. The conventional wisdom in the energy business is that there will be a shortage of crude oil sometime in the middle 1980s and possibly before that. And at whatever point, not necessarily that there is a shortage, but that people perceive that there will be a shortage, then at that point, having an assured supply of 150,000 barrels of crude oil a day in a politically stable region such as Alaska will be a very valuable thing to have. And at that point, which we think will come within the next three or four years, we are confident that the availability of this crude will make it possible for us to find customers for these petrochemicals who will make commitments that will permit us to do the kind of financing that Mr. Lopp has described. And so on this basis, we are proceeding, and I'd like to tell you at least a little about how we plan to proceed. In the original submission, Alpetro outlined the kind of petrochemical units that would be built. It was pointed out at that time that it might be necessary to modify the time of startup for the various units. I'd like to outline to you the manner in which we think now Alpetro would proceed. I must add the changed market conditions 18 months from now when we make a final decision might change these plans. If we were making the plans today, the first unit we would build would be 150,000 barrel a day crude unit. This would separate the crude into such products as straight run gasoline, kerosene, gas oil, and heavy fuel oil. We are confident that we can sell all these products now, except the heavy fuel, on short-term contracts to independent refineries on the West Coast and in Hawaii. We could start the first Alpetro unit, or we can start the first Alpetro unit, whenever we can find an outlet for this heavy fuel oil, and certainly doing that will be the main focus of our early efforts. While the crude unit is under construction, we would start construction of a series of units that would come on stream at about 1 year interval. These would be a unit to desulfurize the kerosene to make it into marketable jet fuel, units to desulfurize and hydrocrack the gas oil to make low sulfur fuel for the West Coast utility market and diesel fuel for Alaska, a reformer to convert straight run gasoline into high octane gasoline, an aromatic extraction unit to remove aromatics from the part of the high-octane gasoline that would not be needed in Alaska, an olefins unit to extract the naphtha from the aromatics extraction. We would hope that at this time, some of the gas liquids from the gas pipeline would be available as feedstock for this olefins plant. Now, there are several reasons for extending the construction and startup of the Alpetro units over several years. With doing this, we can have a small construction force over 6 years rather than a large construction force over 1 or 2 years. This will improve construction efficiency and lessen the local impact whenever the construction is finished. We can distribute the job of training the people and starting up the units over several years. And importantly, it will delay the production of olefins, which are currently in surplus, until the time we think the market will be more favorable. Now let's look at some of these objections that have been raised in the light of these plans. There's an objection to Alpetro taking crude before the plant starts. First, we have no interest in becoming brokers of crude oil. I think that Mr. Johnson, in his testimony before to you in a previous meeting, said that he didn't think he could sell the Alaskan crude to any greater advantage than you are selling it now. And certainly if he, with all of his experience in this, can't do it, certainly we don't have any illusions that we can do it. We want to take crude for some period before we start so that we can trade this crude for products and make processing agreements with other people so that we will have products to develop markets in advance of the start of our plant. It will also give us products so that we can ensure delivery to our customers in the event that there's some delay in the start of our plant. Now, if early delivery of crude will help the Alpetro project, there's no valid reason for an objection unless in so doing we penalize the state of Alaska. So let's examine the question of whether or not outtaking crude early would penalize the state of Alaska. Battelle has reported that while they could see a theoretical possibility that our sales of crude on the West Coast could reduce the average net on Alaska crude, they did not regard this as a practical possibility. Mr. Johnson, in his testimony before you a few minutes ago, has confirmed this. The proposition that we can buy royalty crude that would, on a basis that would permit us to sell crude on the West Coast below the present price, was developed by Dr. Pressing, and unfortunately he based his conclusion on the same incorrect interpretation of the pricing provision of the contract that misled Mr. Johnson. Unfortunately, although this has been called to his attention, he has not, as Mr. Johnson has, seen fit to correct his testimony. Frankly, we wish that Dr. Pressing and Mr. Johnson's original interpretation of the price of the provisions were correct. Unfortunately, they're not, and that the price that we're going to have to pay for crude will be much more nearly the properly competitive price on the West Coast. We've stated that the first unit that we will build will have a capacity to process 150,000 barrels a day of crude. Further, we have a commitment to spend $1.5 billion in Alaska. Now, the principal reason that we will build 150,000 barrel a day crude unit initially is that when we invest $1.5 billion, we must earn charges on this capital. And the depreciation, interest, return on investment will require about 25% per year, or about $375 million a year. You'll have a little over 350 million barrels of crude a year if we take the full 150,000 barrels a day. $375 million a year divided by 50 million barrels of crude is something around $7 a barrel that we must earn on every one of the 150,000 barrels a day simply to cover capital charges. It's not realistic to suggest that we would willingly divert some of the crude on which we must make a minimum of $7 a day to cover capital charges into direct sales where the most we might make is 25 cents a barrel. Now, I think probably the House amendment's been covered adequately. We don't have any quarrel with the broad intent of the House amendment. Dr. Loresh has also told you why they find it unsatisfactory. We find it unsatisfactory for the same reasons. In addition, under the wording of the current House amendment, we couldn't use any of the crude oil for fuel in the refinery, which would be a normal use of it. I think this is all I would like to say about these particular things, and I'd like Mr. Honig will summarize things.
Thank you, Mark. Senators, I would like to summarize by saying why we feel the Alpetco contract is good for Alaska. We feel it provides for processing of Alaska's royalty oil in Alaska. It provides for new permanent jobs and job training in Alaska. It establishes a preference for hiring Alaskans and for training Alaskans. It establishes a new industry in Alaska, which Alaska does not have. It will create increased tax revenues for Alaska with a very small requirement for additional government services. It will provide the basis for other new businesses and related jobs in Alaska. It will enable shareholders of 6 Alaska Native corporations to own a sizable interest in a major energy project. It will favorably affect the economic stability of Alaska, and it will do all this with maximum protection against risk to the state of Alaska. A great deal has been said about why a project like this won't work. We disagree. We're willing to risk our money on our position. We believe it can and will work. We have devoted considerable time.
Senator, the project financing does unequivocally depend on a portion of, and that is going to have to be yet to be defined, as I said in my remarks, a portion of that refinery output being committed to a long-term contract at margin sufficient to support the debt. And I do believe that there will be a portion of that available for long-term contracts. I wouldn't agree with your consultant on that point. Now, none of us are at liberty, and I don't think anyone has made the proposition yet that we know 100% that all those contracts will be available. It's our best judgment that they will be, and if they are, we can finance off of them.
It's your judgment that they will be necessary.
I believe that's the case. I'm not, you know, I haven't had discussions yet.
I just want to clarify that, to the best of my knowledge, that has not been mentioned to me as being contingent at all, and I wanted to clarify from you, has it been mentioned to you, or has there been any contingency made or any promises made or anything with regard to the funds from the Industrial Development Authority?
Senator, Senator, as part of our research as financial consultant to Alpetco, we have evaluated Chapter 61 of the law and believe it is a financeable vehicle under Section 103 of the Federal Tax Code, which permits docks, stores, utilities, and those types of financing to be utilized with tax-exempt financing. And so we have recommended that. We've prepared documents. We've done a constitutional search as well as a statutory provision of a home rule charter is required, and we believe that is a viable option to provide as part of the fund. No, other than our assertion that we believe it is available that we could raise the funds under that provision. If they were a paper corporation, it wouldn't say much for our corporation to represent them. So I believe that they do have sufficient resources, and we're willing to put our name on the line on that to get meet their commitment up to the $10 million that they're talking about.
Involved in the contract
bunch of items is really out there.
Senators, I asked for an early hearing today on this matter because I have some amended remarks to make. I've done a considerable amount of homework since the last testimony that I gave on May the 11th, and I will then forthwith read a prepared statement that I have made amending some of my opinions as expressed in that May 11th statement. Yes, sir. Senators, since testifying before this committee on May 11th, I've received and noted several items of additional information that I consider pertinent and highly significant. Enough so, in fact, to appreciably alter some of my attitudes toward the Alpetco contract as it pertains to royalty oil purchases. These changes also must affect my testimony, and I should like to make the following brief statement prior to further consideration of the Alpetco matter. Following my testimony on May 11th, I discussed the Alpetco contract with Commissioner Laresh and Deputy Commissioner Bonnes, especially with regard to my testimony which opposed the early taking of royalty oil. I had characterized such early taking of crude by Alpetco as a probable indirect subsidy to the project by the state due to my visualizing an opportunity for Alpetco to purchase crude under the contract's pricing formula at a price which would permit them to discount North Slope royalty oil on the West Coast and still make a profit. I found my discussion with Mr. Laresh and Mr. Bonnes very enlightening. Both of these gentlemen are exceptionally well informed, both with respect to the subtleties of the Alpetco contract and with respect to the crude oil marketplace generally. In arriving at some of the conclusions outlined in my earlier testimony, I had used a weighted average price, FOB Valdez, of $11.45, based on the marketing of two-thirds royalty oil on the West Coast in Valdez and one-third on the Gulf Coast. These figures are essentially correct, but do not fully address the unique pricing mechanism in the proposed contract. This pricing mechanism contains a feature that substitutes the average point of delivery price of all of the other producers for the actual price of any producer whose actual point of delivery price is lower than the weighted average of all the other producers' prices. This feature tends to protect the state from receiving a low price from Alpetco under any circumstance, but especially under those actual crude marketing practices now existing with respect to North Slope crude. Specifically, some 61% of the North Slope crude was marketed at Valdez and on the West Coast during March 1978, with the other 39% going to the Gulf Coast. The calculated weighted average price at TAPS Inlet was $5.16 per barrel, which was $11.43 FOB Valdez, a very close correlation with the figure that I had used in my earlier calculations, by the way. However, the pricing in the contract would set the Alpetco purchase price under the contract at $6.09 at TAPS Inlet, or $12.36 FOB Valdez. Since this would result in a delivered West Coast cost to Alpetco of approximately $13.25, there would obviously be no incentive for Alpetco to exercise its crude option, and certainly no way to discount in the West Coast market, since the going rate for North Slope crude is approximately $13 per barrel at present on the West Coast. This pricing anomaly results essentially from the fact that almost all of the crude going to the Gulf Coast is so high. Their crude is thus priced at a weighted average $4.34 at TAPS Inlet. Since the weighted average price of all other producers excluding Soho is $6.09, this price is substituted in the pricing formula as the price per barrel for Soho's crude in weight averaging all of the crude. The foregoing prices are based on actual volumes and prices as reported to the state for March 1978. I've calculated additional simulated conditions for March and have concluded that even if Soho commenced marketing an additional 100,000 barrels per day on the West Coast instead of on the Gulf Coast, and Exxon and ARCO each sold 50,000 more barrels per day on the Gulf Coast instead of the West Coast, the Alpetco price at TAPS Inlet would still be $5.53, which equates to $12.70 on the West Coast. Even this very substantial change in West Coast market balance between companies which I do not regard as likely in the near future, would not produce a contract price low enough to permit Alpetco to discount significantly in the West Coast market and still achieve a profit on the sale of crude. Because of this special pricing feature, the full import of which I had not realized at the time of my earlier testimony, I now believe there is very little likelihood of Alpetco's early taking of crude, and even less likelihood that if such early taking does occur after 25 months, that the state would be adversely affected as to price. In the light of my more complete information, I visualize the Alpetco's possible sales of crude on the West Coast would have no serious effect in the West Coast marketplace. I retract my earlier statement regarding the crude option to Alpetco constituting an indirect subsidy by the state for the Alpetco project, since I have been convinced that the state is reasonably protected by the pricing clause. The foregoing represents a substantial alteration in my testimony since last week. Briefly stated, I now feel much more comfortable about the crude dedication features of the Alpetco contract. As earlier stated, I have been very favorably impressed with the grasp that your Royalty Commissioner and his staff have of the contract and its implications. Certainly, from the standpoint of the present administration attitude, one can feel assured that the benchmark requirements would indeed be rigidly and narrowly interpreted. Thank you for the opportunity to amend my earlier testimony. My change of attitude about part of the contract is based on several hours of calculation based on actual March 1978 movements of crude as reported, and an application of the Alpetco purchase price clause to these actual crude deliveries and modifications thereof. Thank you. Yes, sir. They still bother me, but I've searched my soul to decide if there's a better way to do it, and I have found no better way. I don't know how I would suggest that be improved. I'm also persuaded, Senator, that the word commit perhaps means more in the financial community and in the financial sense that it does than it means to me as a non-legal and non-financial person. Not at all. It's based on a further understanding of the pricing mechanism. My preparation time for my earlier testimony was not as long as I would have liked for it to be, nor did I have quite as much information at my disposal as I have had since that time. I was able to work on the amended impression based on actual deliveries of crude, actual movements of crude, and actual netback prices at tap in. I did not have that information before. No, rigidly and narrowly interpreted.
We have previously sent a letter to
Yes, I think so, and that's a feeling. I can't be precise about it, but certainly I do feel more comfortable and at long range. There is no question in my mind but that a future administration might either more rigidly or more loosely interpret the contract. Yes, sir, that's true. I would hope they would be, Senator.
We intend to create a normal credit agreement that we create for any other company.
That calls for a little more crystal ball gazing, and I think I should
be designed to fund their
equity. And I think it's obvious to all of us that a great deal of interpretation is involved in paragraph 10.2.
Or incidental, other than a normal type of credit.
I haven't seen a way, Senator. I'm puzzled over that, and I think this was a really difficult part of grafting the contract as it now exists, and it appears to me that a strong effort was made to pin it down as tightly as it can be pinned down.
Is there anything that about
there are many things, none of which would rock the earth. And I've made some comments in the latter part of my report last time, my testimony last time, that I said were technical considerations, and I think are not earth-shattering one way or the other. They're relatively minor considerations, and probably not anything that could be materially changed at this late date in any event. Probably wouldn't even be one.
Senator, it strikes me the biggest near-term problem we would have is finding a place to get the energy from this position. And the most likely solution is to be able to execute. All of our efforts over the next few months after ratification will be directed toward getting.
Yes, sir. We're talking about a matter of degree, but of course, as I say, there is room for considerable variation in rigidity and looseness and interpretation of the contract, and I would presume that would certainly relate to the attitude of a subsequent administration.
We have around a period of time, and I'm not sure that we have it for this solution. The contract is converting this heavy fuel into other products, and expensive, and generally not around the
Senator, I want to be very careful, though, to underscore the fact that I consider that I am a qualified consultant in the area of the marketing of crude oil, not in the area of the construction and the profitability of petrochemical facilities. And paragraph 10.2 accepts in one principal respect. I was mostly bothered at the outset by the crude oil ramifications, by the early taking provision, which could be triggered by a loose interpretation of paragraph 10.23d, to be very specific. I have to say that since I find myself less concerned about the whole matter of early crude oil taking prior to operation of the plant, then I have to be much less troubled from the crude oil standpoint about the language of paragraph 10.2. How it goes, how it plays as far as the state's concerned, aside from the area of my specialty, I don't want to be the interpreter of that. Do you follow what I'm saying? That rigidly or loosely, I'm not really all that troubled about the crude oil portion of this thing as it stands right now. And that's the reason I didn't say a great deal more than I did about the word commit.
Operational viability, not operational at a lower level, it would be a financial problem.
Mr. Chairman, I will keep our remarks brief today in light of the fact that we have met with the special committee at least once before in the opening hearings along with the House. And what I'd like to do is just run down once more the philosophy and the technique behind our negotiations on behalf of the state with Alpetco and the other firms that we dealt with. Then run over briefly, very briefly, two or three of the questions that have been raised continually in House consideration of this contract. Now, as you're all aware, last year a change in the royalty statute, essentially required that the state take royalty in kind unless we could show, or unless the commissioner could make a finding that a taking in value was more in the state's interest. And it required that we take in kind under a royalty oil and gas statute that is strongly slanted toward in-state use, which leverages the things we want over and above the price received for the crude. Then run over briefly, very briefly, two or three discussions that have been made continually in House considerations. Now, as you're all aware, last year a change in the royalty statute essentially required that the state take royalty in kind unless we could show, or unless the commissioner could make a finding that the taking in value is more than and require that we take in kind under a royalty oil and gas statute that is strongly slanted toward in-state use, which leverages the things we want over and above.
Well, certainly the economics of 100,000 would be.
It is a royalty statute strongly suggests that the state should use its royalty crude to help create jobs, to lever the refining of products in the state, and to lever associated development. In other words, the statute defines why we take royalty at all, and that is to get benefits beyond those that are available to us in money. Given the basic statute and the amendment which changed the presumption for the in-kind taking, we set out more than a year ago to make a determination of what was the benefit of the state for a large amount of crude oil
this is probably
my first question, of course, that we had to ask was this.
My guess is
was the expectation
no more
in the royalty statute realistic in light of the real world
is going to go down.
In other words, could such a project defined generally by the royalty succeed? There's been a lot of talk about that, both early on in negotiations and since completion. Certainly a large body of academics who did conventional wisdom macro analyses of the situation.
I'm only aware that
name them all, you've heard most of the reports. They said, no, this is not possible.
And project here. You assume
certainly a large body of entrepreneurs, people who put these things together in the past, said, yes, we think we can make it work. We're willing to bet several million dollars a week. From all of this talk, it became clear to us that no one can know right now whether this project can succeed in the marketplace.
No, I don't know that.
We publicly stated that we won't be able to know that.
We
determined to construct a contract to allow the traditional marketplace to decide whether or not this works. And to structure into the contract a shield from the risk of failure for the state.
I don't know.
We set out by setting a boundary in which we would keep our negotiations.
That sounded just announced another time.
That is, there would be no price subsidy with our crude oil. There would be supplemental environmental stipulations. There would be stipulations involving job training and local hire. And there would be a requirement that at least some in-state fuel products, enough to meet our projected in-state demand, be created by any refinery. We set out to set these boundaries and then to clearly establish that the entrepreneurial risk vested where it belongs with the private sector. Now, since that time, all consultants agree to a greater or lesser extent that the contract before you now is a reasonable and fair contract given the presumption. Given the presumption that we want to leverage our royalty share into jobs, in-state products, associated development, and the additional revenue that comes from it. Given that the state wants to lever it into these things which require a successful, substantial private function. given the second presumption that we want the risks of the venture to be strictly and clearly resting on them. All the consultants say, again, to greater or lesser extent, that the contract is reasonable.
No, I think that, I find it hard to put a number on it.
There have arisen clearly several questions
additional
regarding individual sections of the
production to maintain the pseudo
base
capacity at approximately the same level
for
20 years or some number like that.
Most of the fears that I've heard expressed to me by legislators and others revolve around the delivery of crude oil.
We have to find half again as much oil
before actually start up of a refinery. And these fears can be broken down into several subcategories. And certainly, Fred and I thought these through at great length over the preceding months. And we clearly concluded that the risks are not great enough to cause serious concern, given the contract as a whole. Not given one little section, but given the whole machine of the contract. The first fear seems to be sort of a not clearly defined fear that somehow Alpetco is going to get control over our crude oil, and we'll never be able to get it back. Clearly, the crude oil under the contract will be delivered day after day after day. They don't suddenly get title to our in-place reserves out of this contract. At any given time after we start delivering, only a small amount of that oil is in their possession, for which they have not paid. And the security clauses of this contract clearly strongly indicate that. For example, if Alpetco has 30 days of crude that they haven't paid for, we're holding security liens that cover this more than twice. So there's no fear there. Secondly, when they do have control of our crude, they're paying the full price that we could get otherwise. So the fear of our losing money every day when we deliver. Simply not a valid fear. Thirdly, to retain control of this crude once delivered, Alpetco very clearly again has to meet every other term of the contract. Upon their default or their fail to meet a benchmark performance term, we simply shut off the valve. And any attorney will tell you that the presumption is clearly on our side. It's our commodity, and we can refuse to deliver to them. They have not delivered on the other terms of the contract. So basically, the first day we deliver crude to Alpetco does not lock us into delivering it to them forevermore if they don't perform well. Any more than the first day we delivered our royalty crude to Ohio, Exxon, and ARCO locked us into never taking it back in an in-kind take. We clearly have control over our crude throughout the contract, unless Alpetco meets all the terms, which is what we want. The second fear of early delivery seems to revolve around a presumption that Alpetco will somehow contrive to market our crude at a great profit, the profit that we could otherwise make. Now, an examination of the facts, the pricing term of the contract, the facts as they exist in the marketplace, and will exist in the foreseeable future, will show that this just cannot happen. First of all, as Mr. Johnson pointed out, the price Alpetco will pay will be set by the marketplace. In fact, in the interim, in the next several months, it will be higher than the marketplace. Now, anyone who could contrive to lift crude the price higher than the market and make a profit on it is operating in a way that I wish I understood. The second part of this assumption is that the state could make this profit in Alpetco, and Alpetco was perhaps by getting in the spot market. Now, the report that Patel did for the House, I think, clearly dispels that notion. I won't go into it in detail, except to point out that, first of all, seeing the state compete in the marketplace with Exxon, ARCO, and Sahaja is pretty unlikely. Secondly, I don't think that the Department of Natural Resources should have a room full of petroleum marketers with telephones trying to flog the stuff daily on a daily basis. And thirdly, entering into any short-term sales after you've told the producers that you're going to look at incurs a great risk of loss as well as a possible potential gain. Once we give notice, as you're aware, under the unit agreement, that we want to take the tree at the time, we've got to keep doing it for 6 months. And if we have to sell it on a daily basis, we could well take it down. It's even far less than we did. But again, I'd refer you to the sell the deal. Points out that very unlikely to take the same amount of money to make a profit. The third fear that hinges on early delivery is the fear that El Petro never wins and that somehow they just won't do it. Well, we could refer you to six or eight clauses in this contract. They require the building parts of the performance clauses of the contract. It says right early on in the contract that they shall construct and start up the facility for fuels, olefins, aromatics, and prescribing. It says that they have to expend in the contract, they commit to expend $1.5 billion.
Mr. Chatham, we appreciate your concern about whether you'll have enough oil or not, and certainly examining this question is going to be one of the activities that whoever ends up money will be engaged in. But there are several possible solutions to this. First, there's a possible solution that might come out of further oil discovery. Second, there will still be a lot of oil coming down the pipeline from Pluto Bay, even if one eighth of it is not equal to 150,000 barrels. And at that point, we don't think it's out of the question that we could buy the difference between what you're giving us and what we need from the existing producers. So the appraisal of all of these factors are going to have to be part of our appraisal of the total project when we make the final decision. We would not spend the substantial amount of money we plan to spend between now and 18 months from now unless we thought the probability was good.
150,000 barrels a day, fuels only refinery, cost maybe 300 million. Once again, our petrol has contracted to spend $1.5 billion. They can't spend $1.5 billion on this 30,000 barrels a day facility. They could make a lot of platinum. But who would lend the money for? And that's the second. Even though it's not likely that El Petro is foolish enough to let $1.5 billion facility sit behind it, just for the thrill of marketing our oil, which you're buying at market price anyway, it's even less likely that the financial community would loan him $1.5 billion to do this. It's just not possible that they could meet the terms of this contract and not build for the network. Those are the main points of fact that I wanted to address. I get a little excited. But let me back off a little bit and just summarize the fact that I think clearly the legislature has a very important policy decision to make. And there are several things that are obvious. First of all, any contract involves a commitment by both parties. Secondly, any commitment precludes some unknown and theoretical possibility. 15 years from now, the whole world may change. And if we're contracted for a 26-year period, then we might miss out. Clearly, we might miss the detriment as well as the possible benefit. But we have to admit that we don't know what's going to happen during the contract. But I think the real question comes
from sure
whether the potential gains from a contraction and the probability of their realization, whether they can be well weighed against the potential risks of being harmed by their overseas business and the probability of their
risks.
Now, analysis of the real world, the probability of
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add just one postscript to what's been said about the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir. We at Alaska Interstate have used for many years a rather well-known reservoir engineering firm by the name of, it was Butler Miller & Lentz, and now it's Miller & Lentz. And they're regarded as one of the best around. And when we first became interested in the Alpetco project, one of the first things we did was to have Miller & Lentz, who does other reservoir work for us, look at this situation. And while they have, they share the concern that you've mentioned, they concluded that it was premature, as far as they're concerned, to, based on their knowledge, it's premature to determine the exact configuration of the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir, because there's not been enough production of oil long enough to be sure that to make the estimate.
Well, the letter first, I feel that the contract clearly required those things. Anyway, let me just move down one up. I think the letter is that strengthens the contract. However, the legal people say the contract is different. Now, the commitment to extend, I'm certainly not a financial expert, nor am I a priest. That language is drafted by the Department of 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 the the second point was that they would immediately notice us that they would not lift any fees for 25 months. Now that is the way the contract would have worked anyway. The contract says that they don't gain any right to lift fees until several things happen. The two most important things are that they've been able to borrow financial institutions committed to bailing. Secondly, they have contracts for sale of 70% of their output. Now that is certainly the most important venture. That is a litmus test for the financial community to be able to start that. And we felt that it was good enough for us that the financial community was done bailing projects. That means the sign that the project was wrong and we wouldn't lose that. Thank you. Okay. That is whether or not the definition of total project cost includes funds paid for streets. The contract clearly shows that it doesn't. The definition of total project cost says cost required under this contract. They're not required to buy a barrel of crude oil. They're just allowed to. So the word required makes this an unnecessary statement, or what it does is show that they intended all along to purchase the crude to not include the military. Yes, yes. I don't think this improves the... Well, I think the contract took care of all those things. I'm very pleased to have the letter of clarification. Maybe to get some people to get I'm not really sure. The first thing I would do is make a finding that taking in value was indeed in the state's best interest, since the best-in-time contract is unacceptable to the state. Then we would again look around to try to make the test again and perhaps come up with a more modest proposal that didn't have as great a benefit, but maybe wasn't as complicated. But basically, I think it would be difficult for anyone, not as a person, but difficult for the state to again negotiate such a far-reaching deal in light of rejection. But basically, we would just continue to take in value for the person. It's highly unlikely, I think, that Patel went down several reasons for this. Secondly, for the state to make such a sale, we'd have to make a finding the royalty board would, that it was surplus to in-state needs. And if someone is willing to build this thing in-state, but we said, no, we'll sell it outside, then we might well be in breach of the statute. So the marketplace makes it very unlikely that the state could ever break Exxon and Arco's West Coast market. It's been suggested that we could do a short-term sale to Japan as a specific example to get the president going on the exchange. And that's possible if you approve it. But clearly that would be a symbolic thing and not really a possible. I think so, but essentially we would just take in value until something better came up. And, as I say, we went through months. In fact, we solicited for a purchase of the state board in 1675. Didn't get replies from anyone who wanted to build anything in the state. And we did it again last year and really squeezed them and promoted the deal and got four applicants. So I think we've gone through 3 years of trying to get the best deal, and this is it. And I wouldn't expect a better deal to pop up when no one's dropped their deal. Yes, I would. In simple terms, now, I'm sticking to the amendment exactly as they adopted it. And I've spoken to several House members who say the language isn't important, but the intent is important. So I don't mean to throw stones at them when I say that this contract amended exactly as they adopted it would not work mechanically. It would fall apart. You have to understand the procedure that occurs before a barrel is delivered to the purchaser. Under the unit agreement, we give 6 months' notice to the producers that we want to lift so much crude 6 months hence. We can't shut it off except in 6 months. We can adjust it, I believe, Fred, up or down 10% in a month's notice. But the unit agreement itself requires a fairly uniform long-term commitment to lift. Now, the House amendment requires that every barrel that Alpetco takes gets run through their refinery. Now, given the unit agreement and given the other set of facts, that is the way the petrochemical industry works, they might run 165,000 barrels one day, 140,000 the next. They might shut down for 3 weeks. Meanwhile, try to work that within the six-month notice period, the maybe 12 to 20-day transportation period from Prudhoe to Alpetco. And it's clear that there's no way to adjust what we take from the producers finely enough to ensure that every barrel does go through this refinery unless they have ridiculously large storage facilities, which would make the project financially pretty silly. So mechanically, it doesn't work. Now, the House's intent was to ensure that they do build a 150,000 barrel facility, that they do operate it, and that they don't take our oil before we know darn well they're going to build it. I think those were the three pieces that went into this. As I tried to explain today, I think the contract takes care of those three concerns. But the simple answer is that the amendment, exactly as the House drafted it, would make this thing fall apart. Saying, sure, we'll let you sell the carbon, we're going to put in a crankshaft that doesn't fit. That's not what they meant to do, but that's what the exact language was.
Senator, as you know, our Supreme Court decided that that provision was unconstitutional. The case was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and I believe oral argument was heard before the United States Supreme Court about 4 to 6 weeks ago, and the case is at this time pending before the Supreme Court. I would expect the Supreme Court will render a decision this term, meaning within the next month or two, but we have no assurance that that will be the case. All testimony is in, all argument has occurred. It is now before the United States Supreme Court and is up to them to render a decision. They have whatever time it requires them. I would expect they will render a decision before they adjourn, which means within the next 2 months. However, on rare occasion, the Supreme Court asks for re-arguments or something like that, which happened in other cases. In this case, it would be up to you. It's in effect. Our Supreme Court affirmed it. That one could probably, I'm speculating here, get into some lawyers' arguments about whether what could happen given the fact that only before the United States Supreme Court, although I believe in a simple idea, yes, the court will assume that.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Senators, we appreciate this opportunity to discuss with you what we consider to be a very important matter. I'm chairman of Alpetco, and with me today are a number of people who are experts in their particular fields and who will be made available later to answer any questions you may have in their particular areas. We would like to keep our remarks as brief as possible so that you will have a maximum time to ask questions and clarify issues. We've made available to you a copy of the presentation we made to the joint meeting of the Special Committee of the Senate House on March 13th. Before we begin, I would like to introduce our representatives here so that you will know who they are and where you may wish to direct questions to any of them. On my left is Gordon Kane, who is President and Chief Executive Officer of Alpetco. Mr. Kane has over 30 years of experience in the petrochemical industry, most of it as a chief executive. He's formed new petrochemical joint ventures both in the U.S. and abroad, and he is considered to be an outstanding petrochemical authority. With us on my right is Jim Lopp, who is Executive Vice President of E.F. Hutton & Company. Mr. Lopp is co-investment banker for Alpetco, along with Lehman Brothers Kuhn Loeb. His responsibilities are for arranging long-term financing. He is experienced in Alaska financing and is the individual primarily responsible for putting together the technical aspect of the Valdez Terminal financing when he was with another investment banking firm. With us also today is Willard Hanslick, who is the Vice President of Alpetco and a Director. He is responsible for planning and administration. He is also a Vice President of Alaska Interstate Company. John Gunderson, I believe, not here yet. John is a Director of Alpetco, and he's been involved in planning for Alaska Consolidated Shipping training courses, both in maritime and refinery operations. Eddie Rogers is a special counsel and a director of Alpetco, and Eddie is primarily responsible for drafting the agreement from the standpoint of Alpetco and worked with Fred Benes over a period of time doing this. Pat Dyer is with us. He is a special counsel to Alpetco, and he assisted in drafting the agreement, and he is also general counsel for Alaska Interstate Company. Joe Tidings is a special counsel to Alpetco. Mr. Tidings is counsel for us in Washington, D.C., and represents several Japanese industrial groups and governmental groups in Washington. He has accompanied Alpetco on three of our four visits to Japan. Kathy Chandler is a special counsel to Alpetco, and she represents us in the state of Alaska. John Mizzuto is with us also. He is a vice president of Chemical Bank, and Chemical Bank is responsible for arranging our construction financing and our working capital requirements. Mr. Mizzuto is experienced in making similar loans to major energy projects. Terry Eaton is with us. He is vice chairman of Alaska Consolidated Shipping and treasurer of Koniag. Ronald Dagan is with us. He is Alaska representative of Sea Train Lines, Inc., and has worked on our training program. A word or two about where we think we are today. It was over a year ago in May that the State Royalty Board established 8 policies or guidelines for taking oil in kind. Based on those guidelines, as Commissioner Loresch said, they then proceeded to obtain interested parties. After many months of competition and negotiation, Alpetco was selected by the Royalty Board and executed the contract before you. This contract, which is now before the Senate for approval, is unique. We know of no other state that has ever outlined so precisely its requirements for development of its natural resources, and no instance where a company has agreed to undertake such a project without incentives or subsidies from the government. The criteria established by the administration were extremely tight and the procedures followed had been thorough. Formal proposals were submitted and presented last August and October. In September, the commissioners circulated proposed contract objectives and a request for legislative and public comment and suggestions. We met publicly with the Royalty Board in Anchorage, Valdez, and Juneau, and with the State Energy Policy Committee at a public meeting in Anchorage. We have put on programs to educate the public, inform the public in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kenai, and Seward, and also to answer questions. Rigorous procedures were followed in negotiating this contract for the state. The contract was drafted with the consultation of the Department of Law of the state and a prominent New York law firm. Also consultants on the contract were, as has been mentioned, were Smith Barney, Bonner and Moore, and Arnold Sussex. Alpetco's lawyers reviewed the contract with counsel for our lenders and with lawyers familiar with the Department of Energy matters. Further, Alpetco obtained a favorable opinion from the Department of Energy, which serves to protect the state of Alaska's future rights with respect to our taking the crude. I am told that there were some 25 or 30 drafts of the contract leading up to the final executed agreement. It would be difficult for us to imagine how the contract could have been more carefully or more thoroughly drawn. One of your consultants, Milton Lipson, who had both pluses and minuses to say about the Alpetco project, was consistently complimentary about the contract itself. In testimony before the joint meeting of the Senate and House Special Oil and Gas Committee on March 15th, Mr. Lipson said, quote, "I think in many respects the contract is as carefully worded as it can be to minimize the state's risk." He went on to say, "I think that you've got negotiated both by the state and by the Alpetco group as imaginative a combination of factors into a contract as you could get, particularly in view of the fact that nobody else was forthcoming. Yes, it's a heroic effort on both parties' part, and I think a very carefully drawn contract." Following execution of the contract in February, Alpetco made an initial presentation to a joint meeting of the Senate and House Special Committees on March 13th. Which was followed by additional committee meetings to hear committee consultants. On April the 27th, the House Special Committee issued its report, which was unfavorable, and reported out of committee by a vote of 4-1. On May the 2nd, the House voted approval of the Alpetco resolution by a vote of 21-17, then agreed to reconsider, which it did on May 10, when it voted 20-19 to amend the resolution, and then conditionally approved the resolution subject to the amendment by a vote of 32-7. While we have no quarrel or problem with the substance of the amendment, we cannot live with it as written, as Commissioner Koresh has commented. Mr. Kane will also discuss this aspect later. We think there are probably six key concerns which have been expressed by legislators, primarily during the House debate, but also to some extent in the Senate. And we'd like to comment on these six. They're not all the concerns, but we think they're the principal. The first one is, why does Alpetco want to purchase royalty crude before the facility starts up? Mr. Kane will comment on that during his remarks. Will all the royalty crude be processed in Alaska? Kane will also address that question. Will the Alpetco project cost Alaska billions of dollars, as alleged by the Institute of Social and Economic Research in its April 1978 report? Will Alpetco complete the facility, then later get into trouble and ask for a subsidy? Is Alaska committing all of its future royalty oil to Alpetco? And lastly, is Alpetco just a paper corporation, assuming no risk and contributing none of its money to this project? That last question will be addressed by Mr. Locke when he discusses the financial aspects of our proposal.
going back to the third expressed concern, will the Alpetco project cost Alaska billions of dollars, as alleged by the Institute of Social and Economic Research in its April 1978 report? So far as we know, the validity of that ISER report has not been publicly challenged, to our knowledge. Yet at least three parties, in addition to Alpetco, have written specific and strong rebuttals to that report. The ISER report concluded that the project would have a significant negative impact on the state's fiscal position. In other words, that it would induce increases in state government expenditures, which are larger in size than the increases generated by Alpetco in state revenues. First of all, our economists examined the report and discovered three mathematical or procedural errors. The report erred in its calculation of income taxes, second, its treatment of income to the permanent fund, and thirdly, it completely ignored our contractual commitment to contribute 5% of Alpetco's after-tax profits after 10 years to a state-administered fund beginning in the 11th year after plant startup. Reflection of these three errors alone resulted in a $1 billion change, not million, but billion-dollar change, from negative to positive. Secondly, an Alaska economist, Robert Richards, in Anchorage, examined the report and wrote a letter to the director of the Institute, which challenged the reasonableness of the Institute's key assumption, that is, the employment multiplier factor. Mr. Richards' letter states in part, quote, clearly your unreasonably high assumption regarding the multiplier and the population-employment ratio have led you to a substantial error in forecasting the population and employment impact of the Alpetco project, about 3.5 times too high. Mr. Richards' letter concluded, there, the researcher's conclusion is absurd. Finally, Mr. Richards requested Professor Ezra Solomon of Stanford University, dean of the finance school there, to review the ISER study. Professor Solomon's response, which is, I believe you have furnished you, states in part, quote, the alleged conclusion is not a conclusion at all in the normal sense of the word. It is simply the basic assumption which was fed into the model, the computer model, in the first place. Put in the simplest terms, this assumption is that any increase in personal income will bring about a larger increase in state expenditures than it generates in state revenues. Given this assumption, it must follow that any new activity, still quoting Dr. Solomon, any new activity, except new petroleum extraction, which increases the level of Alaska employment and income, must also increase state government expenditures by more than it increases the state's revenues. That is, it will have a negative fiscal impact. The bigger the rise in income, the worse this impact will be. Continuing his quote, in my opinion, the assumption itself is not a valid basis for policy decision about Alaska's future development. I suppose the real question is, do you believe that creating new permanent jobs in Alaska is basically bad, or do you favor adding a reasonable number of new jobs? The next key concern I would like to comment on is the fourth one. Will Alpetco complete the facility, then later get in trouble and ask for a subsidy? Some critics have asserted that Alpetco may complete the facility and later fall on hard times for one reason or another, and then return to the state for a subsidy in the form, probably, of a lower price for the royalty oil. Stripped of its Alpetco trappings, this concern is really just another way to argue for no growth, because all new ventures, whatever size, whatever industry, have an operating risk. In this case, Alpetco's project has about as much protection to the state, we believe, as is possible. The lenders will insist that the project is solid before they lend us any money. If appropriate security doesn't exist, in the lender's opinion, they will not lend the funds to build the facility in the first place. If in the future, due to some unforeseen circumstances, the project should have difficulties, historically it is the lender
the owners,